A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast, brought to you by the ANU National Security College, with support from policyforum.net. In this special event recording, Lisa Curtis and Martin Rasser of the Center for a New American Security join Rory Medcalf and Johanna Weaver to explore the ideas put forward in their recent paper from the QuadTech Network's QTN series. Before we get into it, we'd like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal people, traditional owners of the land from which we broadcast. We pay our respects to the elders past, present, and emerging.
The event today is really the launch of a paper published by the National Security College under the banner of what we call the Quad Tech Network, the Quad Technology Network. This is an initiative that was launched by the Australian government, sponsored by the Australian government last year, in fact, really as a way of shaping and pioneering debate about the way in which the Quad countries, Australia, the United States, Japan, and India, could collaborate on the whole spectrum of emerging and critical technology issues. And fascinatingly, when you look at the Quad summits this year, the two Quad summit meetings, key meetings for the first year of the Biden administration, it's fair to say that a lot of the work the Quad Tech Network has done, convened here at the National Security College, but with international partners, a lot of the work of the Quad Tech Network has helped to pioneer and frame the agenda that Quad leaders have embarked on. So don't say that research institutions and think tanks and universities don't matter in this debate. Clearly, they do. And we're joined today by experts from one of our Quad Tech Network partner institutions in particular, from the Center for a New American Security, to really discuss, I think, the key paper on techno-diplomacy strategy for telecommunications in the Indo-Pacific, a key paper in this second tranche of Quad publications. The authors of the paper I'll introduce in a moment, Lisa Curtis and Martin Rasser, who've been close collaborators with the National Security College on this project. I'm also pleased that we'll be joined by my colleague from the ANU, Associate Professor Johanna Weaver, who's the director of a new initiative here at the ANU, the Tech Policy Design Centre, to challenge, to untangle the key arguments in this paper, which make some quite ambitious proposals on how we can build public-private partnerships in Quad countries, particularly in telecommunications and undersea cables. So let's get underway with the discussion. There are so many recent events that I'm sure will feed into this conversation. Just this week, of course, the announcement of the Digicel purchase by Telstra with support from the Australian government, a pretty strategic development, and many other issues, the implications of AUKUS, for example, on Quad cooperation in tech. And over all of this, the question of China's choices, China's behaviour, and the coercive actions that have in many ways have driven this Quad cooperation. So at that moment, I might turn now to the authors of our paper for some introductory remarks about the key arguments and recommendations that you have put. And I'll go first to Martin Rasser, who's Senior Fellow and Director of the Technology and National Security Program at the Center for New American Security. Martin, we'd love to hear a few thoughts from you.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Rory, and thank you, Johanna, for having Lisa and me here today. And I also want to just thank the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade for initiating and supporting the work of the Quad Tech Network. So let me start with why Lisa and I chose to write about telecommunications technologies and telecommunications infrastructure. I mean, ultimately, you know, these technology areas are the central nervous system of the modern economy, right? And our societies cannot function without them. And that's why it's so critically important that this infrastructure is secure and is resilient and trustworthy. The good news is that the Quad countries are already cooperating quite a bit in these areas, but there's a lot more work to be done. And I think there's four specific lessons from the 5G experience so far that I'd like to focus on, because these ultimately underpinned a lot of the broader recommendations that Lisa and I made in the paper. One is the unacceptable risk posed by equipment from untrusted vendors on these networks. And this is an area where all four countries are very much in alignment. And Australia was really at the forefront of understanding and articulating this problem, and so truly pioneering. Two is the need for greater diversity of trusted vendors, right? A global market with just three major manufacturers of radio access network equipment is inefficient, causes undue supply chain risks. Three is the importance of standard setting. We have to push back on China's subversion of international standard setting. At a basic level, that just means we need to show up, right? Oftentimes, foreign firms, non-Chinese firms just don't have full contingencies showing up at these meetings. And there's some very straightforward things that the Quad countries could do to address that. Finally, there's the rise of Huawei and the challenges that came along with that. Just the fact that shift in the market dynamics occurred was something that we could have foreseen and mitigated much better than we had. And so there's important lessons that can then be drawn to as we start rolling out 5G networks, but also looking ahead to 6G networks, for example. Now, in the paper itself, we specifically addressed the potential for open radio access networks as a means to apply some of the lessons learned. And I think there's a lot of opportunity for innovation, improved economic competitiveness, and of course, there's some distinct national security benefits that flow from that as well. So let me focus in brief on some of the recommendations that we make, and then I'll turn it over to Lisa so she can talk about the subsea cable aspect and discuss some of the other recommendations. So one, the first major recommendation is that the Quad countries need to pursue a clear and consistent effort to inform the publics of the Indo-Pacific countries about the risks of using technologies from techno-autocracies, China most prominently. Two is industry collaboration, right? Public-private partnerships. The Quad members should provide incentives such as tax credits to encourage more and deeper collaboration, particularly for R&D, standard setting, and infrastructure development in third countries. Three is countering coercion. The Quad members need to provide financial and diplomatic support for countries that choose to forego what appear to be at the face value attractive Chinese technology offerings, because these countries have been threatened with economic repercussions by Beijing. So we need to have their backs when they make that difficult decision. And ensuring a united front in this matter will help to demonstrate to Beijing that it cannot exert its will in the region unfettered. And fourth and finally is government financing. I think one of the biggest impacts that the Quad can have on the Indo-Pacific region is creating comprehensive funding mechanisms for secure and resilient digital infrastructure. And we're already seeing some initial signs that our national leaders agree on that point. And that's something that I hope we can see rolling out. So let me turn to Lisa so she can talk about the undersea cable aspects and some of the other recommendations that we make.
Well, thank you, Martin. And thank you, Rory, for inviting us here today for this important discussion. So as Martin pointed out, the reasons why we picked 5G and subsea cables to focus on in this paper. Let me also add that the recommendations that are in this paper, I think, can serve as a template for how to deal with other technology challenges that our countries will face. So the subsea cable issue, I think it's quite evident why this is such an important issue. 95% of global Data transmissions rely on undersea cables. Beijing certainly recognizes the centrality of undersea cables to global data flows, and it's putting a great deal of effort into trying to gain greater market share of the undersea cable industry. Of course, American companies own or lease about half of global sea undersea cables at present, but China is certainly making inroads, and it's set itself a goal of controlling 60% of fiber optic communications market by 2025. So, you know, we've already seen that the U.S. government has discouraged subsea cables from landing in China. Facebook, for example, last year backed out of a project to build a subsea cable from California to Hong Kong. And, you know, we know that China is undertaking multi-country undersea cable projects. One is a 9,000-mile long cable running from Pakistan to Kenya to France. The other is a 23,000-mile long cable with 21 landing sites in 16 African countries. So the Quad is well-placed to meet this challenge, and we see that the Quad is also particularly concerned about the subsea cable development in less developed countries because of their underdeveloped critical infrastructure networks. And the Pacific Islands is a case in point. I think we're going to be talking about the Digicel issue later in the program. But I also wanted to mention that the U.S. Worked with Japan and Australia last year to finance a subsea cable to Palau, showing that this kind of cooperation can work, does work. And the hope is to bring India into those efforts as well moving forward. And as in the case of 5G, each Quad country actually brings an individual strength to the issue. Of course, in the case of US and Japan, they actually account for 70% of submarine fiber optic cable market already. Australia is a leader in creating regulatory frameworks for subsea cables. And India is set to become a key landing point for these cables that will be transiting the Indian Ocean region. So by combining their strengths, working together, they can meet these challenges that are coming forward. And I would say that the need for the Quad to cooperate on this issue is quite urgent. It's certainly complicated by the fact that, you know, these are multi-country projects. A lot of legal issues come into play. But in terms of the recommendations for moving forward, many that apply to 5G apply to the subsea cables as well. The need for public diplomacy to inform the publics about what's at stake on the issue, as well as the importance of collaboration with private industry, really from the get-go, having private industry in discussion with the governments. And this will be complicated, right? Because it's complicated enough when one country brings in private industry, but here we're talking about four different countries and bringing, you know, all four private industries together to address this issue. So it is complicated. So I've talked about the need to bring India into some of these financing arrangements moving forward. But also, we have talked about the need for the Quad to set up a monitoring system to monitor Chinese activity in the Indo-Pacific region, to guard against both sabotage and espionage against subsea cables. So this is something that the Quad can collectively work on together. And then lastly, the need to develop an international legal framework to protect the subsea cable industry. There really is no effective legal framework for doing this. So this is something the Quad can work on together, setting the norms and standards for that legal framework. So in conclusion, it's clear that the Quad has a critical role in ensuring The digital future of the Indo-Pacific is free, open, reliable, and secure. The Quad nations have the collective resources and capabilities to achieve these goals if they coordinate closely and they work in concert together. So that concludes my remarks, and I really look forward to the discussion.
Look, thanks very much, Lisa. And I don't think I gave you a proper introduction earlier. So I just note that Lisa is Senior Fellow and Director of the Indo-Pacific Security Program at the Center for New American Security and has extensive experience across the US government. And of course, Martin draws on government experience as well in the national security community in the United States. I'm going to hand over in a moment to my colleague, Associate Professor Weaver, because it would be great to hear your questions, Johanna, on the paper. But I might just also throw one or two framing thoughts in there that I'd like to hear a little bit more on of in the discussion, if possible. One is that we work often from the assumption that China's dominant role in these technologies is a bad thing, but I think it's important to articulate that. I know the paper does that, articulates the risks, if you like, from Chinese dominance in particularly telecommunications infrastructure. It would be useful to hear a little more about that so that we can, if you like, examine it. Secondly, incentive for public-private partnerships. I mean, we've seen one example recently where apparently the incentive was sufficient for Telstra in Australia to make its decision. But I'd love to hear a little bit more on how we can get that incentive structure to work. With those thoughts, Johanna, over to you, please.
Thank you, Rory. And thanks to Lisa and Martin for a fabulous paper. For those of you who haven't read it, I really encourage you to do so. It's a relatively, for an academic piece, short and pithy paper, and it really does cover really complex issues in a way that makes them very accessible. So congratulations to both of you for achieving that feat. I wanted to put some questions to you around some of the key large developments that we've had since your paper was published. And here I'm thinking particularly around AUKUS, which of course is about submarines, but also has a big focus on critical technology cooperation, and in particular called out undersea capabilities. The recent, just a couple of days ago, announcement by Telstra and the Australian government of the partnership around Digicel, which seems to me to be an example of many of the things that you were encouraging in your paper in terms of the cooperation between public and private, but also the government financing piece. The Australian government in the Digicel agreement is putting $1.33 billion US on the table for that agreement. So I'd welcome your thoughts on that. And in particular, if there are any things now knowing particularly of AUKUS, but also the Digicel, would you have written differently in the paper or adjusted any of your recommendations, having the benefit of hindsight?
Those are great questions. I'll start with AUKUS, maybe. Obviously, there's a lot of focus on the submarine component of the agreement. I personally am actually more excited about the technology cooperation agenda, much beyond nuclear submarine technology. But I think, for AUKUS, this would serve as a great complement to the Quad, and could potentially lead to a Quad plus, including the UK and perhaps other countries such as Japan, South Korea, to have a more broad based tech policy agreement, particularly for an area like telecommunications, for example. There's some very interesting things a broader group of countries could do in order to encourage the development of technology alternatives such as open radio access networks across the Indo-Pacific and other parts of the world. I think the AUKUS development, we could probably cite that as yet another example of how this broader collaborative environment is really serving the broader interests of the tech leading democracies very well. But Lisa, any thoughts on AUKUS?
Yeah, look, I think, we talked about Quad cooperation. AUKUS is brings, the UK into the Indo-Pacific, which is quite interesting. It obviously strengthens the U.S.-Australian relationship and the U.S. security commitment to Australia, and also demonstrates the U.S. Interest in working with allies and partners to, extend the security commitment to the Indo-Pacific more generally, and U.S. presence. And so it's quite interesting on many levels, strategically, but also, as Martin pointed out, on the technology front. The focus is on the nuclear-powered submarines, but the agreements that will be necessary, the technology agreements, will also enhance Australia's capabilities in many, many other technology areas, AI, quantum computing, undersea capabilities, as you mentioned. So I think it's quite a significant agreement. And I would just, contrast the AUKUS, which is, clearly a military agreement, with the Quad, which is focused on non-military issues, everything from climate change to vaccinations, and of course, critical and emerging technologies, which is a strategic issue. But to date, the Quad has not been focused on sort of military technologies per se, even though there's always some overlap there. So I don't think we would have changed anything. I think that it does lay the groundwork for looking more closely at military cooperation, or the potential for that kind of cooperation. The way I sort of see the Quad is they're forming habits of cooperation on non-military issues. But should the need arise, the Quad could probably quickly shift to focusing on more military-related issues. But I think the AUKUS is a good development. I think it complements the Quad and what the Quad's doing on the technology front. And so I think it just further bolsters this idea of collective, collective responsibility, or, collective work to meet the challenges of a rising China across the board.
Thank you. So I think to pull out a little bit in terms of the differences between the Quad focus and the AUKUS focus, so one being more focused on the strategic issues, the other on the military. And also looking at the recommendations that you have around public diplomacy and the consistent efforts to inform the public on the risks of using technology from techno-autocratic countries such as China. And also the prevalence of a push in a lot of the conversations and a lot of the press releases around our shared liberal democratic values. And as someone who's engaged in the region extensively from a diplomatic point of view, one of the things that I find, or have found when I've engaged on concepts like liberal democratic values or the techno-autocracies, the pushback that you get from countries in the Indo-Pacific is, we don't want to have to choose between the US or China. And they don't necessarily see it as shared values. They have, in many respects, countries in our region and even countries in the Quad, have to an element differing values. Of course, there are values that bind us. So I'm just wondering, in terms of the recommendation there of the risks of techno-autocratic, do we also need to acknowledge the ambivalence of countries in our region to terms like this, and also some of the scepticism that they may have towards countries of the Quad's intention, and how do you balance those differing perceptions?
Yeah, that's a really important question. I definitely understand, right, that this this dichotomy between, well, it's either the United States or China. That if you have to choose one of the two, yeah, for a lot of countries, that is not an appealing proposition. I think more nuance, particularly from the American side on these issues, would be very helpful. But ultimately, a lot of it comes down to having a full understanding of what's at stake. And I think that those types of discussions we need more of, because it's not just a matter of, you know, choosing technology from one country or another. It's everything that goes with it. It's, you know, the normative aspect, it's the economic angle, where there are a lot of costs that are not apparent, particularly when you have the debt financing that goes along with the digital Silk Road efforts, for example. Taking all that together, I think, is something that the United States and the other Quad countries could do a better job of articulating with other countries in the Indo-Pacific, so that there's a better understanding of the total picture. It's definitely an area where more work needs to be done. And as the Digicel acquisition shows, you know, it's an ongoing effort within the United States and Australia as well, right? Because it's not because, well, the Australia and the United States banned Huawei doesn't mean it's time for a victory dance. It's ongoing work where you have to constantly monitor and assess what the risks and the threats are and how to best address those. And those answers will change according to specific circumstances. And the core message to partner countries in the Indo-Pacific needs to be that this is an ongoing effort. It's not a decision you make today. It's something you commit to for the long term.
Yeah, I think you're right that countries in Southeast Asia, they don't want to have to choose. And China's heavily invested there, you know, a large economic footprint. But I think what the Quad is showing it can do is it's showing it can deliver public goods that benefit the region, that this is not just about, you know, anti-China. It's a positive agenda, which is asserting a vision for the region that actually benefits the countries of the region and helps the countries of the region be sovereign, maintain their independence. And they need choices, right? In order to be fully independent, they need economic choices, political choices. And I think this is what the Quad is offering. And the vaccine initiative, I think, was well received. And I think, you know, we'll continue to see other economic initiatives that the Quad can assert, so that the region sees that the Quad is providing goods and benefits for the region, that it's not just a sort of anti-China shop that's going to make them choose between one or the other. So I tend to think the Quad has done a pretty good job at adapting over the last year to some of that skepticism that we have seen from ASEAN. And the, you know, particular on the 5G issue, the, you know, the red flags were raised going back a couple of years. It's taken a while for countries to fully understand the risks of relying solely on, you know, Chinese technology for their 5G needs. But I think now you are seeing some countries pause and, you know, see what happens. And so I think that that there has been a raising of awareness on these issues. It's a continual process. And that's why Martin and I recommended, you know, so heavily on the public diplomacy part of this, explaining, you know, why we need to do this. What are some of the dangers? What are some of the risks of relying on Chinese technology? But, you know, I think so far we have been doing that. We just need to continue to raise these issues.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists, and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
I also had maybe an observation on the Quad, just to note that paradoxically, you know, we've often thought of the Quad as it was always portrayed as this balancing anti-China coalition, and China has been determined to kind of demonize the Quad. But fascinatingly, comfort levels with the Quad seem to be rising across Southeast Asia, and it could be that one of the hidden virtues of AUKUS is it actually makes the Quad look like the less confrontational alternative. Now, that I'm sure wasn't deliberate, but if that's one of the silver linings or one of the added bonuses, I should say, then so be it. Back to you, Johanna.
Thanks, Rory. I think that's a really interesting point, and certainly I think framing the Quad as delivering that that public benefit for the region is something, as opposed to the direct competition, will serve it well and is well received in the region. And I think that plays out also, Lisa, with the points that you were saying about that people don't want to necessarily choose between a Chinese 5G provider or solely rely on it. And actually what we're seeing in most economies in the region is that there is multiple different 5G providers that are being adopted, and that is in and of itself addressing some of those core national security risks that we were having. I wanted to drill down a little bit on the countering coercion point, which I guess is actually drilling right back into the point that I was saying we need to go more broadly on. But I was particularly interested in the recommendation where you say that numerous scholars have proposed ideas for countering Chinese economic coercion that could serve as a model for efforts of Quad members providing financial or diplomatic support. I was just wondering if you could speak a little bit more to some of those ideas and suggestions, because I think that's something that is always front of mind here.
So one of the ideas, it's basically to establish a fund, right? So if any one country is threatened with an export halt, or that if China is a major customer for a certain item that the Chinese stop buying it, that type of negative economic impact would then be made up for by this grouping of countries, to essentially serve as a cushion, so to speak, for these countries, which I think is an interesting idea. There's details that would need to be sorted out as to how large of a fund would you want this to be. How soon would this group step in to provide that type of financial safety net? But again, I think a grouping like the Quad is a fantastic forum to have those types of discussions, to see what makes sense for the Indo-Pacific, what kinds of support would you provide? Because there could be perhaps, in addition to just a straight financial support, other things that could be done. And of course, on a diplomatic standpoint, having a more unified pushback whenever Beijing attempts to take these types of steps. We've seen it in various parts of the world, Australia, of course, but also in Europe. So there is a need for something to that effect. But I know Lisa has a lot of ideas on this as well.
Yeah, for so long, China has tried to wield that economic weapon, right? And as Martin said, Australia has been at the brunt of that, as have other countries as well. So even though we would have to think about some of the details of how we do this, I think that it's essential, this idea that we're in this together. We can't allow the Chinese to sort of peel countries off and wield this economic coercion over them, that we need to find a way to stand together, kind of help each other collectively. If countries are facing that kind of economic coercion because of their choices on technology, for instance, that the Quad might be able to step in and have a response or a solution for that country. I think this is a really important important aspect of the recommendations, because it's accepted that we need a sort of collective deterrence response, that we need to work together, collective deterrence. So it only stands to reason that we need a sort of collective response on the economic coercion, the economic weapon that China seeks to wield. So again, the details need to be worked out, but this is something we need to start thinking about seriously and should be part of the the challenge, the response to the technology challenges that we're facing from China.
Great. Thank you, Lisa. Rory, I think you have an audience question.
Yeah, thanks, Johanna. I've got a couple of questions from the audience, and one which we might come back to is, I think there is quite a lot of interest in drawing our speakers out a bit more on the Digicel announcement, which I know you were keen to bring into the conversation, Johanna. So we'll come to that in a moment. But first, I might invite Hayley Channer from the Perth US Asia Centre to put your question, which you will do far more articulately than I can, Hayley. So over to you.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the panel members and also the publication that they've produced, which is really a quality piece of work. I have a question actually about the Five Eyes Technical Cooperation Partnership, TTCP, because there's obviously a technology aspect to the Quad and also AUKUS. However, neither the Quad or AUKUS include Canada or New Zealand. So my question is about, does this mean that either there's not the same political will in Canada and New Zealand to work with the US and UK on defence technology sharing agreements, or is it just a case that Australia has something more to offer than those two other Five Eyes countries?
I think my initial reaction is that Australia has been particularly creative and proactive on pursuing these types of agreements. So I think that has a lot to do with it. Canada, I think, would be very keen to have better collaboration on this. And I think your question ultimately points to the fact that, right now we have all these distinct efforts of smaller groups of countries essentially wanting to work on the same thing. And I've been making the case for a broader technology alliance where you would have a larger core group of countries to do exactly these types of things, because ultimately, semiconductors is a great example, right? Right now you have the US engaging with Japan separately, with South Korea a little bit. There's some semiconductor-focused discussions in the Quad, and there's a separate dialogue between the US and the EU and the Trade and Technology Council. But again, if you really want to address semiconductors in a comprehensive and strategic way, you need a larger grouping that brings in Taiwan and that brings in Israel and Singapore and so forth. And what I'm concerned about, if we have this proliferation of all these smaller groupings, they'll start working at cross purposes and you won't have that connective tissue that you ultimately need to have really collaborative approaches on all these issues. So I would encourage our national leaders to think about the bigger picture. I think for the near term, these nascent efforts will work fine, but ultimately we have to drive to something bigger and more comprehensive in order to make this lasting and to really address the root issue on a whole range of technology areas, because they're very much interconnected and you can't just deal with them in isolation. So that would be my advice to our politicians.
Yeah, and just to on AUKUS, I think, you know, it's a combination of Australian interest and inclination to engage in this kind of defense technology sharing and you know, interest in deploying nuclear-powered submarines. So it's just sort of a natural fit, I think, for the U.S. to be willing to share this technology and to you know, have the same vision for the region. And so, you know, I think it's willingness, capabilities, interest, all of those things, I think, combine to make Australia, you know, a natural partner in the AUKUS agreement. And then the Digicel issue, I think, you know, this shows Australia is in the forefront of meeting these technology challenges. And it's just another example. And I think it will assist in providing, you know, the digital transformation, contributing to that, particularly in the South Pacific, in these countries. I think it's, you know, extremely important. And it's just really great to see Australia taking the lead there. And because, again, this has to be a collective effort as we're meeting the challenges of China's increasing digital footprint, you know, across the globe, but in particular in the Indo-Pacific, and seeing Australia sort of taking the lead in the South Pacific and in the digital development of these countries, I think it's really quite an extraordinary development and very welcome.
What I might do is, given that time is short, I'm going to go to one of the other questions in the chat, which is very focused on the public-private partnerships question, because I think getting to the nuts and bolts of how we operationalize the ambitions in this report is really important. There are other questions and comments on the big strategic challenges, which I'm going to put aside because I think they're for a different conversation, a different group, but obviously very important questions nonetheless. And I would also observe, from my own perspective on AUKUS, having done a little bit of, if you like, research on this now, I'm quite confident that the non-submarine elements of the AUKUS arrangement are essentially going to position Australia, US and UK as a core for cooperation on critical technologies with a whole range of partners, depending on who is willing and capable and what is the project in question. So I think that we're very much on the right track here. Okay, let me go to Josu Castro, you've got a question about public-private sector cooperation. Would you like to read out your question?
Yes, thank you very much, Rory, and thank you, panel. The question, I'll just read it as I've written it. What form might private sector cooperation between Quad members on emerging technologies, what form might that take? And is that likely to take the form of formal bilateral, quadrilateral agreements coordinating public investment into joint R&D and commercialization initiatives? Or is there a better model that's more about supporting greater convergence between private sector players and innovation ecosystems.
And if I could jump in on top of that and just add also, I'd be interested if you can use Open RAN as an example, because I think the observation you made in your paper that in 2019 policymakers had not heard of Open RAN and now it is really being put forward as a solution to many of the sort of challenges that we have around options and viable alternatives to some of the 5G providers. I think it's a really good example.
I'm happy to jump in first on this one. So, Hosu, based on everything you described, I could say it could be all of the above. Absolutely, I think an ambitious, collaborative tech policy agenda could very much have all those as elements. To Johanna's point, Open RAN is a great example, right, of how these four countries can cooperate to really create a shift in how the telecommunications sector is structured. Because open radio access network technologies are software-based, there's lower barriers to entry for new vendors. The proprietary hardware market is very difficult to break into, and that's why it's been consolidating over the course of the past couple decades. But with Open RAN, now there's a lot of new opportunities where new software firms can come in to provide specific offerings. And if you think of the strengths that the Quad countries have, software development is very high on that list. And if you have the government buying power from these four countries, that sends a very powerful message to industry players that this is the direction that these countries want to go in. And then, of course, cooperation on security becomes much easier. You have the vendor diversity that is so important. You have more secure supply chains because you're not dependent on companies in a few small areas. Rare earths is another great example. Think of what these four countries can do together to shift global supply chains. Right now, China dominates mining. It has a near lock on processing. But the Quad countries together have the resources, the know-how, and the expertise to change that. And it will require a form of industrial policy in order to make that shift happen. And that's where I think one of the biggest values of an arrangement like the Quad will ultimately lie, if you can have coordinated policies so that you can effectively shift a global market in a way that you have a more secure and resilient supply chain for these critical materials.
If I can just add there, because I think the way the Open RAN was handled could serve as a model, because you have the U.S. government raising sort of red flags about the 5G issue, but recognizing that the solution would have to come from the private sector, and so communicating with the private sector and enabling the private sector to come up with a solution. That was really critical. So it really is a private-public partnership where, the governments are recognizing a national security challenge, but they also recognize that the solution has to come from within the private industry. So they have to be able to facilitate those discussions and bring the private sector in. And so I think that's how Open RAN has worked and is moving forward. And so you would have to have the same model for other technology challenges as well. The private sector is part and parcel to finding that solution. So I think that was a very good example. And then just to raise, here in the U.S., we have, landmark legislation making its way through the Congress, the Innovation and Competition Act that was passed by the U.S. Senate this summer, authorizing $100 billion over a five-year period to bolster the U.S. tech research industry. You know, this is really a remarkable effort, and it shows the U.S. recognition of the need to support the private sector. And so this is, you know, will be the same for the Quad, as the Quad is working together. The importance of investing in the private sector, helping with those resources, some of the seed money for the research and innovation that's going to have to happen. So hopefully we'll see the other Quad countries moving in that direction, and then be able to, learn from each other, support each other. And I think a great example of this was the education initiative, the STEM education initiative that was announced at the Quad Summit in September, where 100 students will study STEM, and with an eye toward looking at approaching the technology challenges that the four countries are facing together.
If I can just editorialize on that, Lisa, I think that's a fantastic point to wrap up that answer on. I'd love to see that STEM education initiative extended. So it's not only the United States that's hosting those students, there's opportunity for other Quad countries, including Australia, to play to their strengths in education and really be a host for those new generations of expertise that we need explicitly under a Quad cooperation banner. But that's just a quick editorial intervention from me. Johanna, we've got a couple of minutes to go. I think we've got room for one more question if you have a question or a comment to drive the panel, and then I'm going to wrap up in 3 or 4 minutes from now.
Sure. So if I can also editorialize on OpenRAN, I think it is an excellent example of naming a problem and then the power of innovation and ingenuity. And I think, when people say X technology, we're concerned about this, OpenRAN gives me hope that we as Quad countries are able to rise to that challenge. I guess for me, I will go back to the question of visions and values. And, it's in the strategic interests of Quad countries when we talk about vision and values for the Indo-Pacific that we're engaging and aligning those values with countries in the Indo-Pacific. So I just wonder if you have any thoughts, and I guess this goes back to the original recommendation around public diplomacy and ensuring clear and consistent efforts. Do you think there's more that we can do around, as a Quad set of countries, engaging and ensuring that we are aligning and having that vision that aligns, for example, with ASEAN partners?
Who'd like to take that up?
I can jump in quickly, and then if Martin would like to add something. I think here is where I would like to talk about the importance of the Quad interacting with other countries. Not necessarily talking about expanding the Quad. I don't think that is really necessary, at least now. I think it's the foundational grouping. But certainly there needs to be dialogue with other countries. And if you're talking about technology, you need to involve other technology leaders, Taiwan and semiconductors, South Korea, 5G. So there has to be a dialogue to bring these other countries that share the Quad's vision, as you were saying. So finding a way to work together with these other countries. And then, another example is the previous administration, right after the outbreak of COVID, did sort of a Quad Plus dialogue that also involved South Korea, New Zealand, and Vietnam, I believe, which was focused on addressing immediate COVID issues. So I think that is a good model, that bringing other countries in on an issue-by-issue basis for dialoguing with the Quad, and that have the same vision as the Quad countries.
I agree with that point completely. I think the upcoming Summit of Democracies will be an interesting test case to see, how well the leading democracies of the world can align on these issues and hopefully come up with a concrete plan of action to push back against the erosion of democracy around the world and creeping authoritarianism. Because ultimately, I think the core message needs to be that this creeping authoritarianism, even if it happens on the other side of the world, is a direct threat to democracy anywhere and everywhere. And that core message, I think, really needs to be hammered home, that it becomes a very slippery slope. If you lower your guard in one part of the world, that does have ripple effects across the globe.
Look, on that note, Martin, I think we'll wrap up the conversation on that fairly sobering and bracing note. This paper is available on the National Security College website. It's also available, I believe, on the Center for New American Security website. So we're really spreading the word here. I think it is a really useful way to look at practical opportunities, practical options for these pressing problems of technology policy. I want to thank our panelists for their participation today. Thank you, Johanna Weaver, for pushing the conversation like that and for your work. Thank you also to Lisa Curtis for your work on this paper and in so many other areas. And, of course, thanks to Martin Rasser for continuing to be such a valued partner with us here at the Quad Tech Network and for your work on this. Just in closing, I'd note that there are a few more events in this series coming up, so we want to see all of you back in those events, and please spread the word and encourage colleagues and friends to join those as well. On the 4th of November, we're looking at the future of 5G governance in more detail with other of our QTN authors, with Andreas Kuhn and Tricia Ray from the Observer Research Foundation in India, and Johanna will be rejoining us for that. And, of course, also with Jen Jackett from the National Security College. And then on the 15th of November, we're looking at biotech in the Indo-Pacific, with Dirk van der Klay from the ANU and with my colleagues from the National Security College, Will Stoltz and Jen Jackett. So 4th and 15th November, please join us again. Look out for the recording of this event online and share it round. Thank you for your support of the Quad Tech Network. Stay well. And if you're in Australia, have a great day. In the United States, have a wonderful evening. Look forward to seeing you again. Thank you, colleagues.
That's it for today. We hope you enjoyed the conversation. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, thanks for tuning in.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.